This is Gulf Coast Life. I'm Mike Kinnairy. Thanks for joining us. The Southwest Florida Amphibian Monitoring Network, or FrogWatch, was established in the year 2000 in order to collect long-term data on frog communities of the region. Volunteers, which include researchers, students, and members of the public, walk specific routes at night during the summer listening for the sounds of frog calls and collecting that data. The goal is to determine potential factors that might influence long-term changes in frog populations and communities, including natural variation, disappearing and altered habitats, and the impacts of invasive species. Today we're listening back to an episode that ran on March 11th. It was one of the last shows we did before turning our attention to COVID-19. Our guests were the Florida Gulf Coast University professor who's led the study and an FGCU graduate student who's been participating. Let's hear that now. Dr. Wynn Everham is a professor in the Department of Ecology and Environmental Studies at Florida Gulf Coast University and a founding faculty member. Dr. Everham, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Mike. It's a pleasure to be here.
Ann Taylor Hancock is a recent FGCU grad with a bachelor's degree and then a master's in environmental science. Taylor, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
To engage with us and your fellow listeners about this conversation or any of our shows, find us on Facebook. We're at WGCU Public Media. Or on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So the Southwest Florida Frog Monitoring Network, huh? Give us the origin story of this, Wynn.
So I think the origin goes all the way back into the 1990s when scientists all over North America were starting to see weird growth and mutations in frogs. And people, I think people already recognized it, but that frogs became, you know, that metaphorical canary in the coal mine, mm-hmm. or canary in the wetlands.
Right, right.
So that if something's going wrong with the frogs, then we should be looking hard at what that is. So the U.S. Geological Survey started the North American Amphibian Monitoring Program across North America. And Frog Watch, the Southwest Florida effort, started in the year 2000. So a group of people got together and said, we should start listening to frogs and see if we see changes in their populations through time.
Did USGS reach out to people around the country, or was it, did they like put out like a, you know, research proposal and people could glom onto it, or how did the local one get started?
I think it was just birthed by John Cassani, who's now the waterkeeper.
Calusa waterkeeper.
Yeah, for the Coosa River. And it, there wasn't any a kind of a call for funding because it's all volunteer. It's citizens and scientists putting in their time to collect data.
You know, we're familiar now with this term citizen scientist in ways that they're trying to get people to help, you know, many hands make light work kind of thing.
Yeah.
20 years ago, I'm not sure I would have known what that meant. Can you think back to 20 years ago and whether citizen science was a thing that was common back then?
Yeah, I think this is pretty early in that language. I mean, maybe the best long-term database is the Audubon bird count.
Ah, yeah, yeah.
So that's been around for a long time.
Yeah,
but I think it is, again, in the 90s that people are starting to say, wow, there isn't enough money. There's too many questions. We need more data. Is there some way that we could collect meaningful data not necessarily having to hire professionals to do it?
Yeah. Real quick aside, the most recent example of that I've recently discovered is called Foldit. It's something that you can download, and it asks you to solve these puzzles that have to do with the way things fold. And what they're actually using that data for is
DNA.
And viruses.
Yep.
Like right
wow.
now, they have turned their attention to the genetic structure of the coronavirus, and they're using people from all over the world who are solving problems on their computer.
Wow.
Isn't that wild?
Yes.
So, Taylor, how did you get involved with this?
Oh,
the frog thing, not the folded thing.
Yeah. I was an undergrad in biology taking Wynn's scientific process course over summer in 2016. And Wynn, being Wynn, comes in the class, go, hey, you guys want to go out and look for frogs with me at night? It's summer. You don't have a lot of classes. You only have his class pretty much. And I said, that sounds like a ton of fun. Sure. Me and a few people from the class went out. And just had a really, really great time going along our route looking for frogs, and was kind of a cool summer because there weren't really a whole lot of people out there. So it was kind of a cool personal sort of trip of not a whole lot of people scaring off all the wildlife. Mm-hmm. Get to see it a little more often than I remember a few times. I think it was just me and Wynn, and then me, Wynn, and my then fiance, now wife, went out and just had an awesome time finding stuff.
You grew up in Southwest Florida?
Yep.
Did you spend much time out in the wetlands?
As a kid, no. I was very much indoors, computer, hated going outside, hated going like canoeing, kayak, and anything. But then, literally coming to FGCU, even then was I wanted to be an engineer, staying inside, working like CAD, AutoCAD type of stuff, and then just joined the FGCU Wildlife Club. Got introduced to the outdoors, and I was like, I like animals, I like camping, I like canoeing. This is kind of fun. And sort of transitioned to more of an outdoor person.
FGCU can do that to you. So so when you first started here as a freshman, you would not have envisioned yourself walking around at night collecting frog sounds.
Oh, no, not at all.
So there's routes around the county, right?
Yes.
Where are they? Are they all still there since 20 years ago? That was my first thought.
Those are great questions, Mike. So there are 23 routes in Charlotte, Lee, and Collier County. That they all our effort ended up being along with coastal counties. We didn't really get anybody setting them up. Not all of them are active now. I would guess there's around a dozen that are. So sometimes what happens is you get somebody who starts a route, and then they maybe move out of the area, and somebody else doesn't pick it up.
Oh, right, right.
And, you know, it's too bad that I think some of them that we've lost is that somebody puts out a cool route in some urban-rural interface, and then over a period of 10 years – the building overwhelms their route, and they get tired of going out and listening to traffic instead of frogs, and they sort of drop out of the pool. So, now, as a scientist, I'd say, no, you want to keep collecting data there.
Yeah.
You know, the no's are
zeros
important.
Are still data.
Yeah, exactly. But it's not as much fun to go out and stand at this side of the road with cars going by.
So describe how this works. Are you recording it? And so then you go back to the lab and you can deconstruct what you've heard. Are you just doing it like a bird count? You just kind of do it on a notebook or something?
Yeah, more the latter. So we go out, we pull up to each one of our stops on our route. We get out, we record environmental data because things like wind, temperature, and humidity, they can influence the likelihood of the frogs calling. And then we put a timer on for 3 minutes. So this is the North American Amphibian Monitoring Program protocol. You listen for 3 minutes. So the idea is if you do the same thing in the same way over time, then the changes that you detect are meaningful.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if we did it different ways, we couldn't tell whether or not it was a change in the way we did it. And we record everything we hear. So most of the time, you know, other people are joining us. We almost always have a few people where they're doing it for the first time. So we're teaching them the frog calls while we're recording the calls. Oh, there's an oak toad. You know, there's a narrowmouth frog. So I like that aspect of it. It's sorry, I'm getting off your question.
No, that's okay.
Our colleague Serge Thomas was at a meeting with me earlier today, and we were talking about doing the frog calling with some of the ROTC programs that we have on campus. You know, give them the experience to come out at night. And Serge, of course, says, well, you could automate that. You could put recorders up in each of the sites.
Yeah,
and I
had
to say, well, I don't have the money for the recorders. Yeah. But even if I did, maybe we do it for quality control. But there's something important about the human being in the space, listening and recording to the data.
The recorder will make the human less in the moment because they will be relying on their future ability. As a person who records things, both video and still and audio, I can relate to that.
Wow, it's a good way to put it. I remember the night that I took out a pack of Cub Scouts. And, yeah, it wouldn't have been the same if I just said, let me play you what we heard last night.
Right, right, exactly.
Yeah.
And so you said that when we talked before the show, so the USGS has laid this out. So there's three different codes of intensity?
Yes.
Describe what that means.
So it's not real specific. There's a little bit of subjectivity in that.
Mm-hmm.
A calling code of one means that we can hear frogs calling, but there's no overlap in the call. Sometimes I think that maybe we're dealing with something like less than 10 frogs in those situations.
Yeah, I'd say so.
And then a calling intensity of 2 is where there's enough frogs calling of a given species where they're starting to overlap and call on top of one another. And, you know, if I'm, again, thinking about how we handle that data, that's maybe 10 to 100.
Yeah.
And then a calling intensity of 3, a chorus, is where there's so many frogs calling you couldn't estimate how many it is, and it's just a blur of noise.
Taylor, how well now can you identify frog calls? I should have pulled some in and like tested you.
Oh,
that would have been fun.
Yeah.
I mean, are they? I mean, you know, are there a few enough frogs in our ecosystem that they all become distinct voices?
Yes, to an extent, there are 2 that Wynn and I get pretty well mixed up, but we kind of have our own way to tell them apart.
Yeah.
The squirrel tree frog and the Cuban tree frog. The Cuban tree frog sounds like, which is a terrible invasive species, sounds like this squeaky screen door, and it's very iconic.
Yeah. Most people hear that.
I was going to ask you to do some impersonations.
Oh, yes. Taylor's is better.
Do it again. Here it goes. Right. Yeah. Right on.
That, but then there's the squirrel tree frog, which is a small little green tree frog.
Native frog.
Yes. Native and sounds similar, but I think sort of the rhythm or beat of it is a little bit different, where it is sort of not just one movement. It's sort of right?
I say it's more like a rhythmic, like squeaky shoes.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think you're getting the
– I feel like I've heard that one. Yeah. That sounds familiar. If you had to guess, how many of these walks have you guys been on each?
I don't know.
We could probably do math, but that's not our field.
100.
Yeah.
100?
Yeah.
I would say –
I mean a minimum of 4 times a year since 2001. So that just got us to almost 80.
Any particularly memorable ones for whatever reason?
Wow.
Yeah. I would say the one that I mentioned where it was like just me and Wynn and Felicia, my wife, where nobody believes me. But we went by Summit Church and went underneath where the water flows through that little wildlife corridor, and then saw that huge white soft-shell turtle that was probably about yay big.
It's about 3.5-4 feet.
Yeah,
you're on the radio. Remember, you can't.
Oh, yeah. Thank you. They are documented to get that big. They have what's called indeterminate growth. So they really just never stop growing until they hit some sort of limit of food or bodily limit or whatever it is. But nobody believes me when I tell them that story until I say, well, go talk to Wynn. And then if they do, they're like, okay, maybe that's a little more.
There's been – so it's weird. As I start running through my head, most of the memorable nights didn't have that much to do with frogs. Right? I mean, we had a few nights. There was one night where we got, I think, 8 species of frogs right out here in the parking lot outside of WGCU. That's one of our stops, is parking lot number 3. That was an extraordinary night. So there's maybe 10 species that we would normally hear, and we got 8 of them in one night and one stop. But it is a little bit of this excuse to be out at night and sort of the adventures of the things that you find.
Hmm.
That same place down by Summit Church, boy, there was a period of time before Charlie, I'm trying to remember now when they disappeared, where we would look at the spiders along the guardrails. Great colony of black widow spiders inside the guardrails along Ben Hill Griffin Parkway. So we'd listen, and then we'd walk around and look at the spiders. Yeah, I guess. That
would have been like 2004?
Yeah. Hmm. I guess we're
– sound right?
Nerds.
4 years.
If you are just joining the show today, I'm talking with Dr. Wynn Everham. He's a professor in the Department of Ecology and Environmental Studies at Florida Gulf Coast University and a founding faculty member. And Taylor Hancock, he's a recent FGCU grad. We're discussing an ongoing study that began 20 or more than 20 years ago, I think, that's tracking frog populations around Southwest Florida using their calls as data points. To add your thoughts, find us on Facebook at WGCU Public Media or on Twitter. We're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So what's the data showing us?
I was thinking it's about time that he asked us.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was after the pivot.
So so the first 5 years, the data, we were showing increases in exotic species, particularly Cuban tree frogs. Going into the 10-year retrospective that we published in Florida Scientist, mm-hmm. at that point we took the data and collapsed all the data for any given route down to you know, what's happening on this route as a whole. And in there, most of the indications were that the frogs were doing okay. And then as we continued to collect data and reflected on that, we realized that what's happening is that a route as a whole will maintain its frog populations as long as you have a few good spots. So, for example, our spot includes the university. You know, we've got a lot of restored land. Route number 7 in Lee County will always have a good population of frogs as long as the university stays with 50% preserved land. So since that time, and we've got this manuscript we're working on now, sort of the 20-year retrospective, we've tried to drill down into individual stops. So, you know, what happens here as it goes from an old pasture to a housing development?
Yeah.
That's
probably the
most common, you know,
change. Public.
Yeah. I remember when we wrote in that first paper after 5 years that there was some hope that as you took either pasture lands or undeveloped sites and put a housing development on it, but you put stormwater ponds in it, maybe the frog populations would come back. Maybe they would – and I don't think we have that data. I can't think of any of the stops that we've got or through the route where we've documented that you put a stormwater pond in and the frogs reinvade it. Maybe it's just we've disrupted the landscape too much.
Hmm.
We do have some evidence. You know, Taylor mentioned that site down by Summit Church on Ben Hill Griffin. It was that kind of degraded pasture. They put in the church and the fire station. And as part of that, they restored that flowway that goes underneath the highway. They got rid of the exotic plants. They planted native plants. They created this beautiful wetland. And there's more frogs there than there was before the development. That seems weird, but
yeah.
It's true, right?
That was going to be one of my questions.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
We don't have a lot of places like that in the landscape, but we could get more. You know, we could hopefully look at the way that some of the development is happening now and try to do a better job of that development as we go into the future.
Is habitat loss the primary reason that frog populations would be depleted? Because I know back in the early 90s, I think there was also concern about toxins in the environment.
Yeah.
Is what we're dealing with here more just about moving, you know, changing the landscape?
Yeah, I got my answer. You want to try that one first, Taylor?
Yeah. I would say in Southwest Florida, where we are developing so quickly, such a breakneck pace, habitat loss would probably be the number one concern in our area. At least for one, for just not having a place to live, not having the resources they need to live, such as prey, which they'll find it in the habitat that they need to live. But also more interestingly, even if you leave a small piece of habitat inside of a developed area for those frogs, developing around it introduces this pathway for the invasive species, the invasive frogs like cane toads, Cuban tree frogs, which will then come in and either outcompete, they will eat what these frogs are eating, just steal their resources, or directly eat
the frogs.
Those frogs. Because like the cane toads eat anything that can fit in their mouth. They're like Stephen King's Langoliers just going on eating.
Ooh, that's
everything.
A good example. I never thought about that. I agree with everything Taylor said, and I'd add this, that I also think it's altering the hydrology so that we may leave a wetland, but then because we're so concerned about flooding, we ditch it. You know, drain it. And so the habitat, although it's intact, loses quality for the wetlands. And I think it's another one of those examples, Mike, of the, you know, the canary in the coal mine, that if you embed native wetlands in your development, then when the rains come, the wetlands fill up. Not your roads, not your houses. Mm-hmm. The wetlands fill up. That's what they're for, right? And so people who are going to respond to what happened with Hurricane Irma by saying we need more ditches, all that does is cause problems downstream.
Right.
And some of those downstream problems are the harmful algal blooms. You know, you pump water off our landscape too fast into the coast, and there's a price to pay for that. So,
yeah. Sort of this good compromise. I was just at the UF Water Symposium 2 weeks ago, and they actually brought up a really good sustainable option that we utilize on campus, creating a rain garden where you have sort of this depressed ditch-like area, but it's contained, wetland plants on it, and then the water comes, those wetland plants suck up the water, release it into the atmosphere through transpiration, but it's also excellent habitat for frogs as well.
Yeah, and tie up nutrients that would go downstream and feed algal blooms.
Yeah, that too.
And then I want to add this last piece that the frogs and all of us are going to be challenged by the changes in weather that we're seeing associated with long-term climate change. You know, that I know there's some people that are still trying to struggle with that reality and the causes, but just look at the data, right? And increasingly, the data is showing in Southwest Florida that our patterns of rain are changing. So if we go from a regular half inch of rain between 4 and 5 o'clock in the afternoon to a 2-inch rainstorm every 3 or 4 days, that changes the way that water moves on the landscape. And if we're not careful about holding more of it back, creating a landscape where more of it gets held back, then we're going to see things get too dry and flood.
Frogs can be a good indicator of the health of the ecosystem or the wetlands. Why are they important to the environmental ecosystem? Like, what role do frogs play other than eating littler things and being eaten by bigger things?
That's what I was going to say was the role. Right? They're embedded right there in the middle.
Maybe that is the answer.
I think it is the answer. Maybe Taylor's got a better one. I mean, you know, I wish I could tell you that the frogs control the mosquito populations. They don't. You know, they'll eat mosquitoes, but they're not going to prevent us from spraying mosquitoes because we've got really healthy frog population. And they feed a lot of – they feed fish. They feed birds. They feed snakes, which some people don't want, but we like them.
So you guys are going to be presenting this research on March 18th at the Sanibel Community House during one of FGCU's research road shows. Have you done one of these before?
Yes.
Yeah.
What? Describe it for our listeners.
No. Yeah. the research road show has just been a really joy to work with and do. This will be our fourth and last showing of it, where it is us and two other sets. We come in first because we're the best.
I think that's going to be on the radio.
Yeah, maybe. the first 10 minutes is us talking about Frog Watch, explaining what it is and sort of putting this ambiance of putting someone through Frog Watch, showing them images, really explain and showing.
Playing some sounds too, right?
Yeah. And then after us is a team, Joe Muller, doing paleoclimatology stuff, looking at
We've had her on the show before.
Yeah. And then after that is a group of entrepreneurial students who have created their own wedding sort of music business out of that. But it's been a really cool process of us working with somebody to tell the story of our research the way that we want to tell it to a very receptive audience who's really excited to come to us after the show, talk to us, ask us questions. A lot of people with phones. And, do you know what this frog is?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But
can you come take care of the marine toads? In
really
my
good interactions.
Basically an effort just to expose the public to the cool research happening here?
Yeah, I think so. That's a good way to say it, Mike, that I think the people who originated, this is the second year of having a research roadshow, they wanted us to tell the FGCU story more broadly. You know, how – and I think a lot of it is research projects that meet regional needs, but it's also connecting faculty expertise with student education and training.
Yeah.
So that's part of what we do, right, is we are Southwest Florida's four-year university, and we want to be able to share with people how we fit into the region, what we do.
We had last year, we had a student on named Thor who studied, got data on whether a more compact golf swing could be just as effective in an effort to get older people to not hurt themselves as much.
He was on the road.
That was an interesting nexus.
Yeah, and he was on the road show last
year. Yeah.
So I agree with everything that Taylor said, but truthfully, it was outside of mine. I think both of our comfort zones, you know, that – if somebody says, come talk like you did, come talk about frogs. Yeah, sure, I can do that, right?
Yeah.
So they listened to us and they made a script. And we had to memorize a script. Okay, that's different.
It's not a short script.
No. and it's got audio cues and it's got visual cues and it's got blocking where we're supposed to be standing in a particular place so that I'm not blocking Taylor and we're not blocking the images on the screen. It was definitely outside my comfort zone. I'm definitely going to be excited when we're done. But I also feel like I learned a lot. I mean, I think it'll impact in some ways how I teach. So I think that's a good thing.
We're basically out of time. Real quick question. Is there a way for people who aren't involved with FGCU to get involved with Frog Watch?
Yeah. So the Frog Watch website that I should have the URL for.
We'll put it on our web
post. Okay, good. Yeah. People can reach out there and we can, you know, if people want to get involved, they can add into one of the routes. We're going to be – our regular sampling time is June, July, August, and September. So they could come out in June with us. They might want to start their own route, although if somebody is interested in doing that, we might say, could you pick up one of these orphaned routes? You know, something that was started 20 years ago that maybe somebody abandoned 15 years ago. And it would be really helpful to go back and look at that and see how it's changed through time.
Yeah.
Right. Well, that is all the time we have for today's show. I want to thank my guests. Dr. Wynn Everham is a professor in the Department of Ecology and Environmental Studies at Florida Gulf Coast University and a founding faculty member. Always a pleasure, Wynn.
Thanks, Mike.
And Taylor Hancock is a recent FGCU grad. Taylor, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Visit our website, wgcu.org/GCL, to find links with more information about the Southwest Florida Amphibian Monitoring Network Frog Watch. And again, this was an encore episode, so the FGCU Research Roadshow has already happened. If you missed any of today's show, you can always hear all of our episodes in their entirety on our website, or you can subscribe to our podcast feed wherever you get your podcasts. Our show today was produced by yours truly. Our director is Richard Chinqui. Our social media coordinator is Tara Callaghan. For now, thanks for listening. I'm Mike Canary. This is WGCU FM, Fort Myers 90.1, WMKO Marco Island 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida.